This morning, we welcome Robert Ozzie to our pulpit. Mr. Ozzie is a photojournalist and longtime resident of Exeter who writes a column for the Portsmouth Herald, which is in part why he is here this morning. Many members of this congregation read that column, and earlier this year announced that at least one member of our congregation wanted to be sure to say in the paper how much she appreciates Robert Ozzie's column. And then I heard from many other people the same thing. And so here he is to speak with us this morning. You may have heard him recently speaking at Water Street Bookstore over the summer in conversation with Howard Altshuler. The title of this poem is Identity Card. Write down, I am an Arab, and my identity card is 50,000. I have 8 children, and the 9th will come after a summer. Will you be angry? Write down, I am an Arab, employed with fellow workers at a quarry. I have 8 children. I get them bread, garments, and books from the rocks. I do not supplicate charity at your doors, nor do I belittle myself at the footsteps of your chamber. So will you be angry? Write down, I am an Arab. I have a name without a title, patient in a country where people are enraged. My roots were entrenched before the birth of time and before the opening of the eras, before the pines and the olive trees, before the grass grew. My father descends from the family of the plow, not from the privileged class, and my grandfather was a farmer, neither well-bred nor well-born. Teaches me the pride of the sun before teaching me how to read. And my house is like the watchman's hut, made of branches and cane. Are you satisfied with my status? I have a name without a title. Write down, I am an Arab. You have stolen the orchards of my ancestors and the land which I cultivated along with my children, and you have left nothing for us except these rocks. So will the state take them, as it has been said? Therefore, write down on the top of the first page, I do not hate people, nor do I encroach, but if I become hungry, the usurper's flesh will be my food. Beware, beware of my hunger and my anger.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the most gracious and most merciful. Assalamu alaikum. Shalom. Peace. Good morning. Standing here, I'm humbly reminded of what Benjamin Franklin wrote in his autobiography about raising money to, quote, erect in Philadelphia a building about the size of Westminster Hall, expressly for the use of any preacher of any religious persuasion who might desire to say something to the people of Philadelphia. The design and building not being made to accommodate any particular sect, so that even if the Mufti of Constantinople were to send a missionary to preach Mohammedanism to us, he would find a pulpit at his service. Today you offer me your pulpit at my service to say something to you of Exeter. Thank you. I've been here twice before. The first time was in 1993 when war was raging in the former Yugoslavia, and I was trying to bring some young Muslim teenagers from Bosnia to Exeter to study in this church. It's hard for me not to call it a church. Rose to the occasion. Two families I remember well, the Jacobs, who even after suffering a family tragedy, immediately volunteered to take in Denis Avdic, and Lucidians who took in and fell in love with Vedrina, but who also helped out in so many other continuing ways. If there are others of you that helped out and have ignored your presence, forgive me, write it off to an unintended senior moment. I'm here this morning to talk about Palestine and Israel with you, about Gaza and about occupation, about peace and justice. For so long, it's been off limits in America, a third wheel of politics and policy that only the most intrepid of policy wonks and self-employed senior citizen columnists want to straddle. For my part today, I want to give voice to the Palestinians. I believe more each day and week, and more each time we read about terrorism and the death of the innocent anywhere in the Middle East, that the road to peace goes not through Tehran or Baghdad or Damascus, but through Jerusalem. This year, the road swerved through Gaza, and over 2,100 people died. I too have Mahmoud Darwish, who wrote, "Gaza is not the most beautiful city. Its shore is not bluer than the shores of Arab cities. Its oranges are not the most beautiful in the Mediterranean basin. Gaza is not the richest city. It is not the most elegant or the biggest, but it equals the history of an entire homeland because it is more ugly, impoverished, miserable, and vicious in the eyes of enemies. Because it is the most capable among us of disturbing the enemy's moods and his comfort. Because it is his nightmare. Because it is mined oranges, children without a childhood, old men without old age, and women without desires. Because of all this, it is the most beautiful, the purest and richest among us, and the one most worthy of love. There is no road to peace without Gaza. But there is no road to peace unless issues of justice are confronted in Gaza and beyond. There is no path to peace unless issues of equity and dignity are confronted in Gaza and beyond. I believe, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, that true peace is not merely the presence, is not merely the absence of tension, it is the presence of justice. I believe too, as Malcolm X said, I'm for truth, no matter who tells it. I'm for justice, no matter who's for it or against it. It's what I try to reflect in my columns and which I want to share with you in this sacred space today. I repeat, no justice, no peace. Many hear Palestinian and reflexively think the other, Arab Muslim. Many hear Palestinian and reflexively think terrorists. Many think they know truth, other, Arab, Muslim, terrorist, but they don't know what they don't know. They don't know, for example, that the late Labib Nasser, a friend, whose family founded Birzeit College on the West Bank and whose family's farm was recently bulldozed of 1,500 fruit trees, was suckled on the breast of a Jewish wet nurse, and he never had hate in his heart. They don't know that Yehuda Amichai, the great Israeli poet, once told Palestinian poet Naomi Shihab Nye, when she told him about her father nearly having a heart attack when he saw the house he had to abandon in Jerusalem in 1948, Yehuda said, "It is important for me to tell you that I would never have lived in a home seized from an Arab family. Never. There are many of us who feel this way. I live in a home I built myself." I believe Yehuda. I believe that there is a moral core resident in Israel that believes in an Israel not built upon the blood, bones, and exploitation of the Palestinians, who believe that the colonization of East Jerusalem and the West Bank is illegal, immoral, unjust, and unsustainable. That the Israel of the sages is about the heart and soul and not about the idolatry of the land. I also believe that the current hawkish right-wing government led by Prime Minister Netanyahu is opposed to a two-state solution, is convinced that they can crush the Palestinians and make them a subject people, and that they are supported in that mission by a quiescent American government that won't use its power or purse to put pressure on Israel to stop the ongoing colonization of the Palestinian territories. They don't know that it's not about Muslim or Jew or Christian or Unitarian. It's about power and profit and privilege disguised in the cloaks of the faiths of our fathers. Who knows here that there are more Israelis in Netanyahu's government opposed to a two-state solution than there are Palestinians in Abbas's government opposed to a two-state solution. Who knows that America's one-time ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, recently said, in the 21st century, the world will not keep tolerating the Israeli occupation. The occupation threatens Israel's status in the world and threatens Israel as a Jewish state. Let's be clear, East Jerusalem and the West Bank are occupied, not disputed territory. It's a matter of international law and recognition, and not one country, not even its ally, the United States, recognizes Israeli sovereignty over any of the territory occupied in 1967. I'm here today because I believe that the truth is, as Anglican Bishop and Nobel laureate Desmond Tutu says, both the Israelis and Palestinians have to be liberated. But at this stage, the greater onus is on the Israelis, since they are the ones who are in power economically, politically, and militarily. We have to think about ways that will allow them to reflect deeply on what it is that they are doing and bring them back from the brink. I'm here today because I believe that the Palestinians and Israelis need to realize they need each other, that the Palestinians will only get a state if the Israelis let them have it, and that the Israelis will only have security when the Palestinians give it to them. These peoples have fought each other around a dozen times, with continuing daily violent encounters between Palestinians, colonists, army, and police in the occupied territories, and nothing has changed. Indeed, their condition mirrors Einstein's definition of insanity, to keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. I'm not interested in who suffers the most. I'm interested in people getting over it, said Naomi Shihab Nye. What about terrorism, you ask? I ask, where does terror come from? Maybe from people who are terrified. To the Palestinians, it was the Israelis who stole their land, stole their homes, razed their villages, chopped down the olive trees, stole the water, denied their history, and who said everything belonged to them because we are the chosen people. To the Palestinians, over 400 towns and villages were lost, and over 800,000 Palestinians forced into refugee status. Let me confess, had I been a Palestinian, I would have not accepted the UN partition of Palestine, the giving of 55% of my land to 30% of the population because of the sins of the Europeans against Jewish Europeans. A Holocaust in which I took no part, a Holocaust that took place in Europe while I was at home, bent under the knee of British colonial domination. I would have resisted. Let me tell the truth, too, that had I been a Palestinian, I would have rejected the Camp David Accords, as Arafat did. As the terms were so inimical to Palestinian interests, I would have chosen resistance. Let me tell the truth. Were I a Palestinian, I would resist the ongoing colonization, the theft of my land, my identity, my history, and my dignity. I would resist. Frantz Fanon wrote in The Wretched of the Earth, for colonized people, the most essential value, because the most concrete, is first and foremost the land which will bring them bread, and above all dignity. I would resist. A few years ago, I met Yossi Alfer, an Israeli defense and security analyst at a conference up in Camden, Maine, that's held every February. I asked him why, when the parameters of a peace settlement on so many issues dividing Israel from the Palestinians were so well known, why did Israel continue to oppose any settlement of the Palestinian right of return? Why not agree to take a few hundred, a few thousand, I asked. No one expects you to take back millions of refugees, but why not a token recognition of the catastrophe, the Nakba, that had occurred to the Palestinians as a result of the creation of the State of Israel? Because, Yossi answered, to do that would be to acknowledge that Israel was born in sin, and that is impossible. Impossible, a colleague challenged. What country hasn't been born in sin? Indeed, certainly not the United States. Certainly not this nation built on stolen land with slave labor. This lovely UU building is probably sitting on land that once belonged to the Abenakis. I wonder how well paid they were for this land. Humanity is enjoined in Isaiah 1:17, learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed, take up the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow. You cannot learn to do right, to seek justice, to plead the case of the fatherless, the case of the widow, if you are blind to the injustices you have inflicted, even if you felt you were acting justly. Rabbi Abraham Heschel wrote, quote, "There is an evil which most of us condone and even guilty of, the indifference to evil. We remain neutral, impartial, and not easily moved by the wrongs done unto other people. Indifference to evil is more insidious than evil itself. It is more universal, more contagious, more dangerous. A silent justification, it makes possible an evil erupting as an exception, becoming the rule, and in turn being accepted. The knowledge of evil is something which the first man acquired. It was not something that the prophets had to discover. Their great contribution to humanity was the discovering of the evil of indifference. One may be decent and sinister, pious and sinful. If we are both decent and sinister, pious and sinful, we cannot be just." But yet again, you ask, what of terrorism? The Quran states in Surah 5 that if anyone slays a human being, unless it be in punishment for murder or for spreading corruption on earth, it shall be as though he had slain all mankind. Whereas if anyone saves a life, it shall be as though he has saved the lives of all mankind. The Prophet Muhammad was once asked about the best kind of jihad. He replied, "It is a just word in the presence of an unjust ruler. In today's world, there are many unjust rulers, and to resist them is a just jihad. Yet all scripture and all just war theory and international conventions all allow for resistance to oppression and occupation. None allow for terrorism, whether it comes from rockets aimed at civilian populations, suicide bombers in pizza parlors and buses, or from Apache helicopters and American F-16s. Let's remember Gaza today, which has become the world's largest prison camp, where millions live with no more freedom than had the inmates of Alcatraz. Gaza, where Hamas rules. Hamas, who in the 1980s got support from the Israeli government because the Israelis thought they could be a counterforce to Arafat's ruling party, Fatah. Hamas, who came to power through free and democratic elections forced upon the Palestinians by George Bush and Condi Rice, although they were warned that Hamas could displace Fatah. Hamas, who after they won the elections, running on an anti-corruption platform, was immediately denied of any funds to run the government by the Americans, by the Israelis, and Gaza plunged into crisis and into terror and oppression. Hamas that swims, that lives among the people, as Mao once said, resistance is like the fish that swims in the sea of the people. Gaza, which has endured brutal occupation in three recent wars, what do we expect from the disenfranchised, dispossessed, angry, impoverished people denied any basic recognition of their humanity? If we were desperate, would we do desperate things? If we were imprisoned in an open-air prison for years and years, how might we behave? Walter Brueggemann writes, "And then we are drawn up short by terror that strikes us in our privilege as insane, by violence that shatters our illusions of well-being, by death that reminds us of our at-risk mortality, by smoke and fire. We are bewildered, undone, frightened. And then intrude the sounds of justice and judgment, the images of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the imperatives of widows and orphans." Let me tell you a story. A few years ago, believing that young people would have a better chance of moving past the biases and prejudices of older generations, I put together a project with some students. We would explore together the competing narratives of the Israelis and Palestinians, with the caveat that the students who are pro-Palestinians pro-Palestinian would take the Israeli narrative, and the pro-Israeli students would take the Palestinian narrative. And we set up a long time chart on the wall, divided so they could work top and bottom. And the library bought us books, and we started on the project. And within days, we were shut down. Adults, threatened by the ideas of students figuring this all out for themselves, shut it down. They were threatened by the facts. They were threatened by the myths. They wanted to maintain the myths, the self-serving narratives that sustained authority and privilege, and those could not be challenged. So what can we do? What can we, who are willing to confront issues of equality, injustice, poverty, and occupation, do? We Americans who live in privilege and comfort need to learn that there are many in Israel who oppose, boycott, and challenge their government, and we should be able to find a way to support them in their desire to live in freedom and justice among Palestinians. The occupation is a cancer, infecting both peoples, affects the security of millions of people beyond the Holy Land, and has a pernicious, evil, and corrosive effect on a people who have themselves been victim of so many for so long. What can we do to confront, as the Financial Times writes, quote, an occupation which imprisons thousands of the Palestinians' young men, gives their land and water to settlers, demolishes their houses and partitions the remaining territory with scores of checkpoints and segregated roads, where there are almost no foundations for an economy, unquote. Remember when Bill Clinton used to say, it's the economy, stupid? Today I say, it's the occupation, stupid. I support BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction of Israeli companies and activities profiting from the occupation of Palestinian territory and exploiting Palestinian resources. It's controversial. Many Israelis say its intent is to delegitimize Israel. Supporters say it's a way to bring Israel into compliance with international norms of behavior. Israel says it's being judged differently than its neighbors. It's true. But it's at Israel's invitation. None of its neighbors claims to be a Western bulwark against the barbarian hordes. None claim to be the only Middle East democracy. No other claims to have the most moral army in the world. And if you make those claims for yourself, be prepared to be criticized and rebuked if you fail to live up to your own standards. Israeli Bernard Avishai, visiting professor of government at Dartmouth, writes, boycotting companies operating in the settlements is not the same as boycotting Israel. Many Israelis, myself included, refuse to buy wine, eggs, beauty creams, fizzy water makers produced in the settlements. The least we can do is demonstrate against these ersatz destructive communities by refusing to let them profit from our purchases the same way they've profited from the cheap land and tax breaks that drew them there in the first place. And Jewish columnist Peter Beinart wrote a column in the New York Times entitled, To Save Israel, Boycott the Settlements. He said, American Jews should lobby to exclude settler-produced goods from America's free trade deal with Israel. We should push to end IRS policies that allow Americans to make tax-deductible gifts to settler charities. Every time an American newspaper calls Israel the democracy, we should urge it to include the caveat only within the green line. In some ways, I'm sorry I needed to be here today to help dehumanize the Palestinian narrative and give voice and beg for justice to a people entitled to be an equal partner for peace. The overwhelming anti-Palestinian media bias, from NPR to the New York Times to Fox, even MSNBC, routinely denies voice and authority to the other. If the Palestinians are delegitimized and we do not speak for them, we are all complicit with the occupation. We are complicit with those who pursue power and profit at the expense of peace, at the expense of our mutual humanity. Let's pray now to confront the mysteries of our being and for perception, wisdom, energy, and courage to step away from the brink, to counsel our friends, embrace our enemies, and live in justice and peace. Write down, I am an Arab. Write down, too, that as Yusuf Islam, who most of us grew up as knowing as Cat Stevens, once said, I am confident that, in the end, common sense and justice will prevail. Amen.